Yeah, thank you very much. Really excited to be here today. Kind of a neat moment for me. I truly started in the RIA, and so much of my success, I definitely can for sure say I would not be where I am today without the Cincinnati RIA and a lot of people in it, like Jerry, others in the crowd. I'll mention some of my story, but I use the RIA a lot and the people in the RIA especially to overcome some limiting beliefs, overcome some fear, overcome lack of knowledge, lack of experience. I really utilized this group, specifically for me in Cincinnati and some in Columbus, to help me get to where I am. Did nothing special. God didn't give me any special talents or gifts. Just kind of kept taking the next step. So, yeah, excited to share that with you. I'm just realizing I don't have a clicker. Where do I never grab the clicker? Yeah. Oh, was this it right here? Is there a clicker for the? Somebody back here. Well, until then, I'll click the button. I like to move around, so it'd be better. So, a little bit of background on me. When I was 8 years old, I was pretty sure that I was going to play in the NFL when I was older. That was my dream. I had a diehard dream. I was very committed to this dream. So, what a day in the life of an 8-year-old that knows they want to be in the NFL someday, what that looked like is I would wake up early. I kept a little journal, a little log in my room to make sure that I did my 50 push-ups, 100 sit-ups, and then I had a jump rope in my bedroom, and I would jump rope before school. So I made sure I did that every day because I was pretty sure those are the things you needed to do to get to the NFL when you're older. I would actually wear ankle weights to school. So under my jeans, I had ankle weights on. My, 8 and 10, 12-year-old mind, more weight, it means your legs are going to get stronger, you're going to get faster. That's going to prepare you for the NFL. I convinced my friends to do this. So I had multiple people. Before you get to the NFL, you want to do really well. And in school, and we had big dreams for when we were going to play high school football. So I convinced them to do this. The next step was that we ate all, I mean, whatever the cafeteria served. Thank you. Oh, just put that in here. Thank you very much. Okay. So cafeteria vegetables, in my opinion, aren't very good. You guys still hear me well? Feel like I went down. Okay. But I felt like at the time that's what's going to make us stronger. That's what's going to get us, bigger, bulkier. So again, for me, and I convinced my friends, we just had to eat the vegetables in the school cafeteria. So corn was especially rough. What we found out was that sometimes just putting like hot sauce on it or barbecue sauce would take away the taste. So we did that, but we had to eat those vegetables because we were committed. I especially, but convinced my friends to be committed that not all of them wanted to play in the NFL, but we all wanted to have a really good high school football team. So we did all those things. I tell you all that not to brag. It's really not much to brag about. But for me, this was how I established some grit. I was able to, have a dream, have a vision, and take tiny little steps, like putting on ankle weights, like eating corn in the school cafeteria. And I did those things for years just because I wanted to be a good football player. And to some level, it did pay off. Our school had actually never made it to the playoffs in football. in my senior year with my friends and I who committed to wearing ankle weights and eating all the vegetables. We went 10-0 and went to the playoffs for the first time in school history, won a playoff game. So we did do that. But really for me, this was just, and because I got some of that payoff, we all did, I got to see, man, all that hard work, it did finally pay off after years and years of going through all that. And obviously there's so many more things of practice and being in the weight room and things like that. It did finally pay off. But unfortunately, not all dreams come true. If you can't tell by looking at me or you don't know me, I did not make it to the NFL. I actually didn't even come close. I couldn't even.
I saw you at the Super Bowl.
No, you did not. I wish you had. You did not. I didn't even make it to Division I. I did play some Division III football. That was a lot of fun, but I had to get a new dream. That dream did not work out. A lot of dreams don't. I worked very hard. But again, I established, you know, a pattern of working hard. And I did see a lot of success, had a lot of fun with that. So I became a physical therapist instead, just a small step down from being an NFL player. Oops. So went to school for a really long time. You see that book. I'll talk a little bit more about that book. I'm sure a lot of you, maybe all of you know that book, but I really went the poor dad route, meaning, you know, got a ton of education, just how much education can I get, you know, what good job can I get that's going to pay me well, and I'll do that, and I'll work hard and keep moving up and, you know, just make a good living. I did outpatient physical therapy for 1 year, but then I went to home health, and this is a great job for my family. I had a lot of flexibility. I was able to, you know, my patients would come to my phone. I could kind of schedule them whenever I wanted. Most of home health are elderly patients, total knee replacement, total hip replacement. They can't get out of the home very easily initially, so I'll go in and do their physical therapy with them in their home, and then they'll go to outpatient. So I'm just calling them up, you know, in the evenings, you know, when can I come? So for me to get a half day off, full day off, and honestly, I was rarely working more than 40 hours a week. So really kind of a cush job. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know, that's not what I'm wired for. I don't believe God created me for a job like that. So I was pretty quickly unfulfilled in that job and not challenged. And so I felt like there's no way I can do this for the rest of my life. So, you know, in presenting that to my wife, she reminded me that I went to school for 7 years, spent a lot of money. We have to get our doctorate now in physical therapy. So, you know, I figured out I went to school for 20 years in a row. So that's a lot of education, seven of them in college education. But I didn't love that job. So I got on with a company. I was doing home health for a company. It's actually a staffing company here in Cincinnati called ProLink Staffing. Came on with them. Didn't really know that much about them. I should have done more research. But I came on as a home health physical therapist. Pretty quickly, they asked me if I was interested in being the clinical director. And I was, you know, as I explained, I'm, you know, pretty bored, not challenged. So, yes, let me do that. So I came in with them, and it was a startup company at the time. This is like a $1 billion company at the time, now. But at the time, it was a startup company. I came in like year three, probably had maybe 30 employees at the time. They have hundreds of, maybe thousands of employees now. So that was very challenging, exciting work. And I was quickly doing no physical therapy at all. I was managing all of our therapists, but I was really helping build this division for this company. And I was really enjoying my work. I mean, it was very challenging, exciting as a startup feel. But now I'm at the other end of the spectrum as far as it's not a great job for my family. I did not have flexibility. So I really felt like I was at the other end of the spectrum. And at this time, my wife and I are starting our family. So we had two young kids at the time. And that's a tough time. You know, my wife was home with them most of the time. She's an RN, was working PRN at the time, but home with the kids a lot. And so when your wife's home with the kids a lot, it does give you flexibility, but she's also ready for you to be home at 5 or 5:30, not 6, 6:30 or 7. And working weekends is not ideal either. So that didn't feel right either. So I was really, you know, wondering what else is there. And the other thing about both of these jobs is that I didn't see the potential for financial freedom and time freedom. You know, with the physical therapy job, I did have a good bit of time freedom. Not a ton, not as much as I, you know, maybe dreamed of. But I really didn't have an opportunity for financial freedom, in my opinion anyway. Sure, I could make a little bit more. I could have come in the office with the company, you know, and done something else. But there just wasn't that upside potential. When I came in with ProLink, I had more of that. I still don't think I really had an opportunity for financial freedom. I had potential for financial gain, but not that freedom I was looking for. And I definitely didn't have the potential for time freedom, because the better I did with that company, the more responsibility I got and the more time it took. So that's what I wanted. That's what my wife and I wanted. That's what we wanted for our family, and we didn't see that. So didn't want to go that far. I was left wondering, is there another option? Is there another way? And so I really started searching for that, started networking. I didn't join the RIA yet. I wish I would have. That would have been obviously the people to be networking with. But I did know some people doing some entrepreneurial things. I had a buddy at church that was in real estate full time, you know, met with him. And he gave me some good advice that I'd like to pass on to you today. And that was, he said, Lee, is there any way in your job you could get more freedom in your job, more flexibility? Because for him, I think he was selling insurance when he got into real estate, and he was able to work from home, and he really had a lot of flexibility. So he was able to do real estate on the side while he was selling his insurance. As long as he met his goals and, you know, did the things that the company was asking him to do, they didn't really ask him any questions. So the fact that he was working 20 hours every week on the side, as with a real estate side hustle building his portfolio, they didn't care about that. So his question to me was, Lee, can you do that? The answer at that time, again, I wasn't doing home health anymore. I was in this, you know, startup company, really hustling. No, there was no way I could do real estate on the side. Again, with my family, with us starting our family, young kids, I was already away from home too much. So that was not an option for me. And so it challenged me to start thinking, okay, well then, what are my options here? I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. How many in the room have read Rich Dad, Poor Dad? Okay, I figured probably all of you. It was definitely very impactful for me. I mean, I was already thinking this route, but I'm guessing for you it was impactful. And what I felt like I got from that book, and again, maybe it's because of where I was at in my, you know, stage of life and my journey, was that there is another option. I felt like there is another way to do things. And, you know, even if you read that book and you don't come away with thinking it's real estate, I mean, obviously, Robert Kiyosaki's big in real estate, but I think you get an idea that there are people in this country, especially, I think especially in America, but all over the world, but especially in America, there are people playing an entirely different game. And that, you know, then you think of cash flow, the cash flow board game. But there are people playing a different game. And the more I learned about this, the more I felt like I want to play that game. I don't want to do home health, physical therapy. That's great for my family, but not challenging and fulfilling. And I don't want to climb the corporate ladder, which is challenging and fulfilling, but not good for my family. So I decided I want another option. I decided I need a new dream. And I got a new dream. And my dream was that I was going to own apartment buildings. So I like to dream pretty big. If you saw that earlier, I had that dream of playing the NFL. That one didn't work out, but I was, you know, hopeful that this one would. So I got a new dream that I was going to buy large apartment buildings. And so what's a day in the life of a future apartment owner look like? At that time, for me, I was driving around in my car all day. So, okay, I didn't explain that part. So what I decided, and again, maybe this pertains to you. Maybe you have an option to do this. So I was climbing the corporate ladder, and again, there was no freedom, there was no flexibility within that job to get into real estate, and I knew I wanted to get into real estate, or at least I wanted to try. So I left that job at the end of 2016, and I went back to home health physical therapy, again, a job that I'm like, there's no way I can do this for the rest of my career, it's boring, it's not fulfilling, but I did have that flexibility. I did have that time freedom in that job. So I knew going to that job, it would allow me the freedom to start a real estate side hustle. I took probably a 30% pay cut going back into that job. I just say that to show, I mean, I was committed to this new dream. I was committed to this. Also, you know, one part of being able to get into real estate, in my opinion, is to establish a financial foundation, to have good habits of spending less than you make. And so I'm going to give you a few steps here later, but the first step, I think, is building a financial foundation that will allow you to take some risks. Because if my wife and I were spending all that we made when I was at that corporate job, I couldn't have taken a step back. She was, again, PRN as an RN. So my income was what we spent, but we didn't spend it all. So when we took that 30% pay cut, we did not have to change our lifestyle because we had a lot of margin in our lifestyle. We were, you know, pretty frugal. So I just say that's an encouragement. But also with your job, the cool thing today is because of COVID, I think more than ever, a lot of people have the flexibility in their job, right? A lot of people work from home. And so maybe you have some flexibility to start a real estate side hustle. So that's what I did. I went back to home health physical therapy, doing much like this young lady's doing here. This is what I was doing during the day. But a lot of that is driving around. So I had a lot of time to listen to podcasts and books and educate myself and just get an idea of what I want to do. I mean, I didn't know right away I wanted to buy apartment buildings. I knew real estate. You know, Robert Kiyosaki got me going down that path. But the more podcasts I listened to, the more people I heard, I identified with the people that were in apartment buildings and decided that's the route I wanted to go. So I was meeting with anybody who was willing to meet with me. Again, I was not part of the REIT at the time. I wish I had been. Jumped on Bigger Pockets. You guys heard of Bigger Pockets? Yep. So great. But that's national. I think in my opinion, the way I got started, your local network is a lot more powerful than meeting someone on Bigger Pockets that lives in California that does not understand the Midwest and is not going to partner with you on a deal. I mean, maybe. I know people that have done these things, but I think your local network is a lot more powerful. So I met someone on Bigger Pockets, but they were local, sitting in the room today, Paul, a good friend of mine, and I asked him, can I meet with you? Because I, you know, on his profile on Bigger Pockets, he had actually done some stuff and I hadn't. So I met with him, and this was really pivotal for me, and I'm just encouraging you to do this as well. This is why it's great that you're here. It's great that you're in this network, because Paul was 10 steps ahead of me, but he was a regular guy in my neighborhood doing what I thought I wanted to do. He was already doing it. And so sitting there with him, not only was I learning from him, but it was just a proof of concept that he's doing this. He's doing this right here. It must be possible. Because, you know, when I was attempting to sell, I had not sold my wife on this dream. When I was attempting to sell my wife on this dream, we knew nobody that was doing this. And so she reminded me of that frequently. Nobody's doing this. Why would we do this? What makes you think we can do this? And so finally I said, well, this guy named Paul is doing this. And he's doing it right here in Lebanon. We just live up the road. And I mean, if any of you guys know him, he's not that smart, right? I mean, his wife's sharp, but no, he's actually very intelligent. I've learned a ton from him. But that was pivotal for me. So just an encouragement to you. That's what this RIA is all about. That's what it's about. I was searching, again, for financial freedom, but also time freedom. That's what I wanted. I wanted both of those things because I felt like I had one or the other in either of the two jobs that I'd had so far, but I wanted both of them. I knew I would need a lot of grit. And I go back to, you know, starting where I had the dream to get into the NFL. I knew I would need a lot of grit, maybe even more so. But the cool thing I'll tell you about real estate investing that I think you already know that's different than trying to make it to the NFL is that you don't need a certain amount of God-given talent. You don't need a certain amount of size, speed, and strength. Most of those guys are created very, you know, pretty differently than I am. In real estate, you need a lot of grit. You need a network like this, and you need to jump in and take action. You guys all have that. You're all here. You've all taken the first step. So I'm very confident that you can do it. Real quick, why apartments? I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. You guys are in here. But, you know, just real quick, why not flipping? Why not wholesaling? Why not single family homes? Well, for me, and again, I'll just say, for me, I think there are a few benefits that separate specifically rental real estate. And so single family homes would fall into this. I'll get into the bigger stuff. But for me, rental real estate, I already gave the first one away. Did you guys see the first one? I saw it. Okay. First benefit that I think that rental real estate has that flipping, wholesaling, something like that is consistent cash flow, something that can pay you every month. That's what I think is one major benefit. It needs to be a benefit of rental real estate. Any ideas of what some of the other ones are? Yeah, appreciation. Yeah, tax benefits. Yes, yes. That's kind of a tax benefit in the other one. But amortization, so the loan's being paid off, and the beauty of it, who's paying off the loan? The renters, the resident, the tenant, right? So That's something you get with rental real estate. Again, single family homes we mentioned appreciation. When you hold, when you flip, you don't get any appreciation. You force appreciation, but you're not going to sit there and benefit from the market, benefit from the government devaluing our currency. Talk about that a little bit later. And then there's some real tax benefits. A lot of you guys know that even better than I do. But there's a key benefit of multifamily real estate or apartments that I think the smaller stuff, so single families, doesn't have. Anybody have any ideas of what buying larger apartments or bigger multifamily?
Diversify your downsides by the number of tenants you have.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, economies of scale and use of scale, and that's what that's talking about. That's exactly right. In my opinion, that's one thing, and I'll talk about a little of my story, that you just can't get very easily. There are people that do it, but with single family homes, it's very difficult to reach scale. Now, you don't have to. You can do very well, with a small portfolio. There are people that have. I ended up deciding that I wanted that scale. I wanted some of the benefits. So that is, to me, the one of the things, but the main thing that you can get with multifamily. So if you're here, maybe that's something you've already figured out. But I think that's the one thing that sets apartments and bigger multifamily apart from the other rental real estate. And I think rental real estate is really set apart by those four things. So with more units, Paul started hitting on this, but you just get more of these benefits, right? So if you have a single family home, and you're renting it out, you get cash flow. Hopefully you should be. You've got your amortization. The resident, the tenant is paying off the loan for you, right? You're going to have appreciation. Single-family homes do appreciate very well, right, over time. And there's tax benefits to owning that. But that's times one, right? The second you go to a duplex, now it's not two for two. Don't get me wrong. Single-family homes per unit will cash flow differently than a quad, differently than a 100-unit. But you kind of get the idea. As soon as you go to a duplex or a quad, you get times two, times four, a lot of these benefits. You go to a 100-unit, you now have times 100 on some of those things. Cash flow, you're going to split up more amongst people, but you get more of that. And I believe, and this really gets to the scale piece as well, is that it's easier to manage. I think managing a 20-unit apartment building is easier than managing 20 single family homes. 20 single family homes, okay, I got an amen over there. 20 single family homes, you do get 20 times the cash flow, 20 times the amortization, the appreciation, and the tax benefits, but you have 20 times the number of roofs, right? You have 20 times, I mean, how close are those 20 single family homes? It'd be really difficult to get 20 single family homes in one neighborhood, right? Paul's pulled this off by having almost like all of his stuff in Lebanon. It's difficult to do. Most people that have 20 single family homes are spread out all over Cincinnati. If you own a 20-unit apartment building, it's in one spot. Might be one roof. It might be a few, but it's one property, right? They're all right there. It's easier to manage. So that scale is big. But I'm not going to pretend like it's all good. It is harder to get started in multifamily. It is difficult to go and get a 20-unit apartment building. It's very difficult to go get a 100-unit. Almost any of you, if you've got some capital or a friend or family member has capital, you've networked here, you know a little bit, you could pretty easily go buy a single-family rental, right? It's a residential loan. If you've got a good W-2, you can go do that. It'd be very difficult to pull off, and I would not suggest you go buy a 20-unit apartment building if you've never done anything like that. And if you try to do that, especially if you get into a 50-unit, 100-unit, the broker's not going to take you seriously. You're not going to be able to do that. So there's a lot that you need to do. It is harder to get started. That's why I'm here today. Hopefully I can help you start taking a few of the steps that are necessary to get started. One way to go, the way we decided to go, was we had a big dream, but we decided to start small. I love this quote. I was going to read it, but it's a pretty long quote. I don't know if you guys have heard this quote before, but Theodore Roosevelt says, the credit does not go to the man who criticizes the guy or the girl doing it and calls out where they've gone wrong. The credit goes to the man or the woman that's actually in the arena, that's actually doing it, that's actually sweating, bleeding, trying, failing, succeeding, That's who the credit goes to. So I just love that quote. You should look it up, because you have to take action. You have to do it. You can sit there and point out how other people have done things incorrectly, and you're never going to do anything yourself. So you got to take action. And sometimes the best way to do that is just to start small, because the hardest step often is the first one. So it's just about getting started. So yes, I think it's good to have a dream, a big dream. If you're in here and you're dreaming of doing apartment buildings, great. I think you should have that dream. I'm telling you, you can do it. But it is a big dream. So sometimes it's good to start small. So I knew I wanted to buy large apartment buildings, but I couldn't quite get my head around it. More importantly, I couldn't quite get my wife's head around it. My wife, Hannah, is amazing. But she did not go all in on real estate like I did. I did have her read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I don't know if you guys are going to believe this or not, but when she read that book, she said to me, I'd rather be the poor dad. So that, I said, you know, well, that you got it wrong. You got to read it again. So I'll explain some of that. Her point was, you know, there is some comfort. There is some consistency in a W-2 job. And that is fine. That there are plenty of people. We now syndicate apartment buildings. We partner with people. We partner with passive investors. If you want passive income, this is not the room to be in. This is not passive. What I do is not passive at all. We have people who invest with us, and they do it passively. It's truly passive. You do have to vet this whoever it is that you're investing with. But once you decide on that, it is passive. You can have a W-2 income and invest passively in apartment buildings and in other real estate. We talk about that all the time in the REIA, right? Like, go find those people. So there's nothing wrong with people that say, actually, I would rather take the poor dad route. And I don't mean you're going to be poor. Like, that's, to me, that's not what the book is about. The poor dad route is taking kind of the more general route of having a job. And there's some people that love their jobs. And I hope there are, because if they all did it actively, nobody would invest in our deals with us. But there's people that enjoy their jobs and they want that consistency. They want the health benefits and all that to come with. That's great. You can live a great life doing that. You should still invest in apartment buildings. You should just do it passively. So that's the route my wife wanted to take. I didn't. So after some back and forth, we decided to start with a flip. This right here, where my son at the time is walking through the jungle in the grass there. This is where we started. So I wouldn't recommend any of you start here specifically. This was a really bad buy. So to my timeline, left the climbing the corporate ladder job at the end of 2016. It took me until August of 2017 to buy this. Online auction, sight unseen. Now I did go see it, and I did, somewhat break in just to check it out. There really wasn't much to see. It was all bad, but I just could not wait to get started. So we jumped in. And it was rough. We put in a ton of hours. Again, that grit, that sticking with it. I was determined. It was just, for me, it was just, it's a matter of time. It's not if, but when. And we're going to plow through. So this wasn't a great buy, but we did well, and we got started. So we flipped this house. It took a ton of work. And what this house did for me, this flip, it was a perfect picture. I felt like God gave us a perfect picture that, and again, this is my opinion, but I think a lot of you would agree, there's nothing wrong with flipping. I think it's a great way to get started. It's how we got started. But flipping is not investing. Flipping is another way to trade time for money. Now, it is in real estate. So again, I don't, it's one of those things, like I would never do this specific house again. I probably would flip again. It's something I want to get our kids into, make them go flip a house like this. But I wouldn't do this again. It was just another way to trade time for money. So God gave us this perfect picture because, like I said, when I left my job, I took about a 30% pay cut, went back to home health physical therapy. So remember, I've got this job, making plenty. Don't feel bad for me by any means, but a lot of time freedom. So now I've got this time freedom that I was looking for, but not the financial freedom. That's what we're going to do, real estate. Well, we if you stack this flip on top of the job I had as a physical therapist, now I'm literally spending just as much time at work that I was at the corporate job where I had no time freedom, right? And we did make money off this flip. We made the same amount as the pay cut that I took from that corporate job. So I substituted one very busy job for two jobs, spent the same amount of time, made the same amount of money that year. But I did get started in real estate, right? I did get in. I did take that first step, started making those connections. So again, I do not regret that. I think it's a fine way to get started. It did get us started. But, you know, as far as selling my wife, if you've got a partner that's not into it, I kept telling people, with this flip, I have to prove to my wife that you can make money in real estate. We can make money in real estate. We can do it. And it's going to make our lives better. I mean, if you're here, I think if you're getting to real estate, that should be the ultimate goal. It should improve your life, right? And that's what the time freedom is all about, right? So that's what I was trying to prove to her. With this house, we did make money. It did not improve our lives. Again, right back to where we were at the corporate job, right? So my wife said, she's like, you told me about like cash flow, this like residual income. I don't see any of that in the flip. I said, you're right. We didn't get any of that. So we moved on to a duplex. So we took that next step. We bought the duplex at the county auction. Back to connections and having a network. Paul and I bid against each other on that duplex. I outbid him for it. He told me right after, when you're ready to sell it, I want to buy it. And I did sell it to him under a year later. But that duplex, another great experience, another great step. It was basically a flip. First day we went in, fun story. You know, we had squatters in one unit. So it was an older gentleman and his wife that lost this. She had passed. He was going to move into a nursing home, so they lost it, so we bought it. So they got him out, got him into a nursing home, so the building's vacant, but his nephew and some friends and stuff were living there. So the local police met me out there the first day. We kicked them out. They were surprised by this. They thought they could just live there for free. They asked to have the day to get out. I gave them the day. One of them overdosed that day. So we had to call the squad out, get them out. I drove the other two out to Wilmington. So great first day. Again, going really well as far as convincing my wife that real estate is the way to go. But the duplex was a big difference, because once we flipped the duplex, we held on to it and we got renters in. And now we're making consistent income. We're seeing cash flow. And we're now, you know, we're counting ahead and going, this thing's, you know, and in that cash flow, buried under that, one of the expenses is our debt. And the residents are paying that, and there's still cash flow, right? So now we're starting to see the benefits of rental real estate. And of course, we knew over time, this thing's going to appreciate, and there's tax benefits here. So that was a real key difference. And so it was a proof of concept. But again, what you don't get with some of the smaller stuff is I'm doing some math in my head. I don't remember for sure, but let's say we were clearing $4,000 a year with this duplex. You know, pretty good. We bought it right. We you know, rehabbed it. That's great for a duplex. But we want to make four times that per year, five times that per year. Do I really want to own 20 duplexes? Do I really want to own 30 duplexes? Right? Maybe. And that can be a great way to go. Again, some people do that. They own a small portfolio, and you can do very well, but it is limited. Finding 20 duplexes, closing on 20 duplexes, getting 20 loans, having 20 duplexes spread out across Cincinnati and Dayton, that's just limiting. That your scale is limited. So while we saw the benefits of rental real estate, proof of concept there, for me, we also saw that we don't have the scale, but we gained a lot of experience through this process. Again, that's why I think starting small is a great way to get going. We built a track record, okay, that's going to be important later, and we built momentum, right, and it got us in the game. That's the most important thing. If you're sitting here and you're saying, I want to buy apartment buildings, get in the game. There's different ways to do it. I can talk with you after. Some people start passively, get in that way. They invest some money into a deal and start to learn. Some people will partner with somebody. That's certainly an option. One way to do it is to start small. So, we had done a flip, a duplex, but again, the dream was to get into apartment buildings. So at some point, you're going to ask yourself, are we really going to do this? Are we just going to keep doing the same thing? Because doing another flip, doing another duplex, that seemed pretty doable, right? Once you do it once, you know, doing it again seems pretty doable. So it felt like we could do that again. But to go out, so this is our quote here. This was my wife and I. Just felt like we were overwhelmed, okay? So, you know, we had questions like, how do we evaluate an apartment building? That seems very different, right? That's very confusing. I'm going to talk a lot about that today. How do you get a commercial loan? Once you get over four units, you get into five units, that's a commercial loan. It's very different. The underwriting process for the bank is different. The way they evaluate you and the property, it's very different. That felt overwhelming. How do we find money partners? So I don't have enough money to go buy an apartment building. Okay, and that gets talked about a lot in the REIT, and I love that part of it because I'm going to talk about this more later, but this is a team business, especially if you're getting into apartment building. So I felt like, how are we going to get money for this? And then how do we manage it? I mean, a duplex, honestly, was kind of hard enough. We didn't really enjoy managing it that much. How the heck are we going to do a 20 unit, right? So, and then what if we fail? I think that's what holds a lot of us back in many areas of life, right? And that was certainly the case for us. And this is a pivotal moment. So a lot of you may be here right now. I know a lot of people in this room have done deals. If you really want to get into multifamily, this is a pivotal moment because I'm sure you have all these questions. I'm going to give you some answers. I'm going to get you started, maybe give you a guide to get going. But it's a pivotal moment. At some point, you do have to decide if you're going to push through or not, if you're going to commit to it and stick with it. Because just like when I was wearing the ankle weights and eating the corn, it's going to take years until you see results in some cases. Again, you can start small and you can say, well, what if I just do a duplex or a quad and then eight? It's not going to take years, but it may take a year. Again, for us, we did a flip in 1 year. That's all we did that first year. The second year, all we did was a duplex. Okay, and then we sold that. So after 2 years, I own nothing. All right, 2 years into my journey to owning apartment buildings, I own nothing. I'd flipped one house and one duplex. That's it. But I was still willing to stick with it. So you've got to decide if you're going to do that or not. Because truly in this, if you're not all in, you will not succeed. You really have to be all in on this. But encouraging, if I can do it, you definitely can. I did nothing special, okay? We did take action. And the one thing I'll say, you know, this is just a quote everybody's heard, but the one thing that I did do is that when we got knocked down, we got back up. And when we came to a wall, we eventually broke through it. So that is the one thing I did do. That grit that I established with my dream to become an NFL player, I use that again and again, and you will need that. You will definitely need that. So what does it really take to get started in investing in apartment buildings? That's why you're here today. I believe there's five steps that I'm going to go over with you. But as you can imagine, what do you think that key ingredient is? Grit. It's grit. You got to stick with it. You got to be willing to push through. All right, so step one. Anybody have any ideas what step one is? Huh? Learn? Lunch network? Yeah, get educated. Yeah, that is step one. Cool thing is, many of you may have already have done this already, been doing this. That's why you're here today. You know the quote, you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. Teach a man a fish, he'll eat for a lifetime, right? That is so true. And the way you do that in this space to me is find someone who has already done what you want to do. And so that's good for anything. If you want to get into single family homes, don't come talk to me. I've actually never owned a single family rental, I've flipped a house, stuff like that. So I can maybe tell you a couple things. I'm not the guy to come to. Find somebody who has done what you want to do. I'll add one caveat to that. Make sure they have the life that you want. Because somebody may have had success in the business world. If their life sucks, then don't model your business after their business. You might learn from them. Yeah. And I will say, I mean, from Paul. He had time to meet with me, drive around, go to his properties. And I was like, I want to do this. And I felt like I want to do it a little bit differently. But this is the flexibility, the freedom I want. And I also, you know, he shared some of his numbers with me. I'm like, this guy's got a lot of upside. He's got financial freedom coming. So I want to do that. So make sure the person that you're looking at has the life you want. So this is when the REIA came in for me. So again, very overwhelmed by getting into apartment buildings. Felt like we kind of did the flip, kind of did the duplex a little bit on our own. Again, had some good people like Paul in our lives at the time to show us a little bit. But we kind of just went and did it. Did not feel like we could do that on a 10 unit or a 20 unit. So fortunately, again, in my networking, another guy from church, Scott Ellsworth, who some of you have probably met here, he's on some of the panels. Scott Ellsworth, and I go to church and he said, you've got to join the REIA. So I joined the REIA. Right when I joined the REIA, found out that there was an apartment investing focus group. And so I joined that right away. That's my dream. That's what I want to do. We used to meet at a La Rosa's, this La Rosa's right here, over by the Tri-County Mall. We would pack into like this room in the back. And Mark Hutton, who's in here, was teaching us about apartments. And this is where I got my start. This truly is what put me over the edge to actually take action. This is so important. Mark still runs the apartment focus group today. You can learn so much from that. There are some things in all of these steps, especially the next step, you can really learn there, and it's so important. So you don't have to go to the La Rosa's anymore. You can hop online. It's easier than ever. Again, some things with COVID, there was some good that came out of COVID. Maybe you don't have to drive over to this La Rosa's. You can hop online. It's still is it the first Monday of every month? Third Monday of every month is the apartment focus group. Learned so much there, would not be where I am today without that. And again, another example, or this is a good example, again, of somebody doing exactly what I wanted to do, and I was going to learn from that person. So I think Mark, at the time, I know you'd done some smaller stuff. I think you already owned a 25 unit. I think you owned the 40 unit maybe already, or maybe you were getting that at the time. But Mark had done exactly what I wanted to do, and so this is the guy I wanted to learn from. There's coaching. There's mentorship. Sometimes you have to pay for your education. Again, with the RIA, the RIA, compared to other coaching programs, and the RIA is extremely affordable. There's tons of coaching programs out there that are $20,000 to get started. So the fee you join to be a part of this per year and then go to Mark's focus group is peanuts compared to what you pay for those coaching. But there's some good ones, and there's some people that go and do that and do very well. There's masterminds, there's boot camps. I really think you've got to do something like that. You really need to get educated on a different level. And what are you going to gain from that? You're going to build even more confidence. Again, as Mark is teaching me these things, I'm building even more confidence as I'm seeing him do that. I'm starting to believe it's possible. I'm starting to say, okay, again, you know, seeing Paul do that stuff, okay, I can go do that. Now seeing, okay, well, Mark's done this. He acts like he didn't do anything special. He just, you know, did these steps that he's teaching me. Okay, I can do that too. And Mark's going to be there with me. And it convinced me to eventually take action. Right? So the first step is to get educated. I haven't mentioned yet. Some of you are following along. That's good. I gave you a handout. It's kind of like, you know, having sermon notes, I guess. But just so you can kind of take some notes. But I also want you to have this because I want you guys to go take action. You don't have to go buy an apartment building in the next week, the next month, even the next year. But if you want to buy an apartment building at any time in the next year or two, you're going to have to start taking action. Yeah, if you don't get handouts, looks like there's a couple more. But as far as education, getting taking action, who has done what you want to do? So whatever it is, if you want to start small and you say, I want to get a duplex, who here has done a duplex? Has anybody in the room bought a duplex? Awesome. I mean, look how many people, right? Has anybody bought bigger than a four unit, anything bigger than a four unit, right? So all these people have done commercial deals. So they understand commercial loans. They understand maybe getting a money partner to come in with you. They understand what it's like to manage those. So these people, I mean, that many people, it's a lot of people in this room already have done exactly what you want to do. You got to find that person. So I left space there. You network afterward. If you don't mind, again, who has done a commercial deal? Who has done something bigger than a four unit? There's a lot of people that you could start talking with. So get somebody's name down here. Get their name, get their email, get their phone number. Again, mine all started with Paul and then going to Mark's focus group. Without those two guys, would never have bought an apartment building. And so I want you to set a date. Give yourself a deadline. If you're not going to take action, it's not going to happen. So write some people's names down, meet some people at this conference, and give yourself a deadline. The second step, anybody have any idea what the second step is? It has to go, it's what Mark was teaching us one of the things he was teaching us, but I think one of the most important things he was teaching us. You guys are good. You guys are awake. Yes. Learning to underwrite. Another way to say underwriting is to evaluate or to assess. That's what you do. So if you torture data long enough, it will confess. I think that's true. You really do have to do a good job of that, though. So your goal when you're underwriting is to decide, how is the property operating today, right? So how do you figure that out? Well, in commercials, in commercial real estate, in the bigger stuff. Not all of it, but there's going to be a broker involved, much like a realtor with single family homes. But there's almost always going to be a broker involved, and then the seller. They're going to give you this data, right? But as you can imagine, you're going to want to dig into that. You're going to want to investigate. Maybe you trust a little bit, but you want to verify, right? Because you cannot trust everything a seller tells you. You guys know that, right? So it comes down to income and expenses. You've got to really dig in and decide what is the income of that property. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. I'm going to show you guys some underwriting because I think it's so important. But you have to dig in. You have to figure out. And then you dump all this into an underwriting spreadsheet. And it's going to tell you what to do for the most part. But garbage in, garbage out, right? Your underwriting spreadsheet is only as good as the information you put in. So you've got to make sure you are really good at figuring out what the actual income is. For example, the broker is going to sell you on the dream. That's their job. They're going to tell you this is the rent you could go get. How might you figure out if that's actually true? Anybody have any ideas? Yeah, Rent-A-Meter, Zillow, Apartments.com. Like, if you were a renter, where would you go? How would you find a rental? Right, Facebook, whatever. What is your competition? Whatever the property is, what's your competition actually charging for rent? People in this room. Bunch of people in this room, just raise their hand. They own, either they have or they own now. They might own in the area. What are they getting? You know, the broker tells you can get 1,000 for a two bed in that area. People in this room say there's no way you can only get 900. I would trust the people in this room 10 times out of 10 over the broker, right? So you've got to do that. And then you put that good data into the underwriting spreadsheet. The problem with that is you're not done because all of that data tells you nothing about how the property is going to operate for you. So the real trick to underwriting is you actually have to figure out how the property is going to operate in the future. Because are you going to make money off of last year's numbers, the seller's numbers? Or are you going to make money off of next year's numbers, 2 years from now, 3 years from now? You might own this property for 10 years. And of course, you do not have to figure out what it's going to do in 10 years. I'm convinced everything's going to be worth more because the government's going to continue devaluing our currency. So it's all going to be worth more in 10 years, so don't worry about that, but you got to get there. So in the next year, are you going to cash flow? 2 years from now, are you going to cash flow? That's what you have to figure out. So that's kind of the trick. So you're really trying to predict the future. Another big thing you have to throw into that is CapEx. So just like single family homes, I imagine most of you that go and buy a single family rental, you're going to put some money into it on the front end. So great, you have experience doing that, but again, we're talking about scale. So if you're going to buy a 20-unit apartment building and you think you're going to get 20 units, imagine times 20, right? So you think a single-family home, you can maybe again, it's not exactly one-to-one. Single-family home, maybe you're going to dump 20 grand into it. And a unit, you can probably get away with 10,000. But 10 times 20 is all of a sudden $200,000. So these are bigger numbers. So, and I say that because a lot of time, most of the time, we should be thinking we're going to add value, right? Thinking that, you know, most of the time you want rent to go up. In order to get rent to go up, you usually have to put money into the property, right? Especially now, today, the crazy rent growth, the COVID boom is over. Rent has plateaued in bigger multifamily. I can tell you, I don't know if that's the case for you, but In a lot of the hottest markets around the country, rent is actually going down a little bit. Now, they're still way ahead of where they were 3 years ago. I don't feel bad for them. But it is going down. So don't think it's just going to go up. Most of the time, you have to put in money. Did you have a question? Yeah. That's a good point. That is capital expenditures. And it just means the big projects that you're going to do. So like the big upfront money. And maybe not upfront. Maybe you'll do it later. But it's just, you want to have that money set aside. Sometimes you can get an extra rehab loan. We've done that before. But you want to have that money ready, I think, up front. And those are the big capital expenditures, the big projects. You might replace a roof. You might replace windows. And then I consider the big unit renovations to be part of that CapEx budget. And so that's a big thing you're going to do. So just give you some, this is on your sheet as well. I want you guys to have this because sometimes, you want to start with some just basic underwriting, right? So you want to get some basic numbers. There's two simple underwriting rules that I want to teach you that they aren't the end-all be-all. I can still, maybe, you know, there's deals out there that don't meet these rules that might be a good investing. But the first one, have any of you guys heard of the 1% rule? So I think this maybe is more of a single family rule that a lot of people use. I like to use it in multifamily, to be honest with you. So just real quick, just to give you some numbers. So imagine you're buying a 50-unit apartment building, right? It's all there on your sheet. It shows a little bit better up here, so I think you're better off looking up here. But you buy it for $5 million, right? So simple math, you're buying for $100,000 a unit. That's not crazy these days in nicer areas. And your rent, and again, you've got to confirm this, but your rent is on average $1,000 per unit per month. Okay, so all you do, you take that 1,000, divide it into 100,000, divide 1,000 by 100,000. That gives you 1% in this scenario, okay? So this is breaking it down per unit. So again, you can imagine you can use this on a single family home, but this is, it's just like if you had one unit renting at 1,000 and you bought that whole property, the whole single family for $100,000, it's the same idea. Here we're buying it per unit. So this deal right here would meet the 1% rule, okay? So I'll go to the next step. So I want to teach you real quick how to figure out the cap rate and what that means. If you don't already know, a lot of you might. And then I want to talk about positive leverage. That's become much more in vogue now with interest rates taking off. But this same property, let's say you're buying it for $5 million. And again, you confirm, you're very confident that the income is $600,000 and that the expenses are $300,000. That leaves you with a net operating income of $300,000. Real quick, is your debt included in your expenses in this case or not? No, it's not. So that's the one thing. Your debt is not part of this equation. So you keep your debt out. It's not included that's what we call below the line. So when you figure out net operating income, you don't take the debt out. So it's $300,000. So all you do is you take the the $300,000 of the net operating income and divide that by your purchase price. In this case, you get 6%. So that's your cap rate or your capitalization rate. So what that basically means is that if you're kind of comparing it to stocks, that's like your equity multiple. So that's like the equity multiple that you're paying for the cash flow. Another way people explain it is if you bought the property for all cash, if you put $5 million, you took $5 million in cash and bought it for $5 million, and then your NOI is $300,000, that's a 6% return. Okay, again, doesn't take into consideration the debt. But that's what that is. So let's say you were able to go get debt on this at 5%. That's not happening today, but I needed this to work. So let's say you're getting 5%. Then all you do is that you take your cap rate, you subtract, you want your cap rate to be higher than the interest rate on your loan. And in this case, the difference is 1%. So you have 1% of positive leverage, right? So just the idea is that your return, you're getting a return, your equity multiple, your cap rate is higher than the return you're giving the bank. And that's important. It doesn't have to be the case, but I want to talk a lot about cash flow. I want you guys to find properties that cash flow. And it's very difficult to cash flow if you don't meet the 1% rule and you don't have positive leverage. Now, I'll say two things. I'm talking about, again, I just said with underwriting, you're not concerned about how the property, as concerned about how the property was operating in the past, right? It's about the future. Maybe rent is not $1,000 today, but if you're sure you can get it there, then you can get it to the 1% rule. Again, now you're speculating a little bit, but that is part of this business. I'm sure you guys have done that a little bit with single families. Same thing with the cap rate. You can't change the cap rate once you buy, but your operating cap rate will change because if you can change the net operating income, and we're going to talk about that, then your cap rate goes up, right? And so if you buy with a 6% interest rate and you're buying at a 6% cap rate, then you don't have positive leverage. You're at least even, at least you're not negative. A lot of deals today, people are buying at 6 cap and they've got 8% interest. That's going to be difficult. I wouldn't suggest it. I wouldn't do that personally, but you can increase your operating cap rate. And we'll talk more about that. So these are just simple rules. Yes?
So Lee, you're running these numbers on pro forma, not on actual.
No. Okay, so both. And so I'm going to show you that in the underwriting. So both. So what I'm talking about here is this is on actuals. Okay, so this is getting into the deal. So this, I think, is what's telling you, is this a good deal or not, based on today's numbers. So I want this to be actuals. What I started to talking about, that's pro forma. When you say, okay, it's 6% cap rate that I'm buying at, and it's a 6% interest rate, but the rent is so far under the market, I know I can increase rent. I've got a CapEx budget. I'm going to put money into it. So I know my NOI is going to go up. Therefore, my operating cap rate is going to be much higher. Then I'm going to have positive leverage. Now we're talking about a pro forma. So good point. This, though, this back of the napkin math, I want you to use actuals. This is for you to decide if this is a good deal to get into or not. Yeah, yeah. I'll get you first. Yeah. Yeah, good question. The debt is always going to be different. So when we're valuing properties, that's one reason they strip it out, is because if I'm selling to you, I'm going to try to tell you how the property's operating. I'm going to convince you you need to buy it for $5 million because it's spitting off $300,000. But I don't know what kind of debt you're going to get on it. You may not get any debt. You may get 50% leverage. You may get 80% leverage. So that's so variable, and you get to decide what you do, that's not factored in. Another thing is that debt, again, that's going to get paid down by some of that NOI. So you need to make, you got NOI here, then you pay your debt, and then it's cash flow. Your NOI is not cash flow, but it's just, it's variable. You can do so many different things with it. You don't have to get debt. So that's why they don't include that. And your resident's going to pay that off for you. Yes.
Do you recommend 1% being a good goal for positive leverage?
I do. Yes, I do. And again, it doesn't have to start there. You want to get there, but if it does start there, you're going to have a much easier time with cash flowing, which, again, I think is so important. So I actually do want to show you guys this underwriting. So this is a spreadsheet that Mark Hutton gave to me and that I used for years. I did graduate to a different one because we syndicate now. So we bring in people, we do a preferred return, we do all these different things that this spreadsheet doesn't have. But that's one thing I like about this spreadsheet is that it is more simple. Let's see if I can pull this up. Maybe I can't. Is there a way to switch screens? Okay. Okay. Well, then I messed it up. Oops. Okay, that's all right. I can explain some of it here. The main point I wanted to make with this is that you need an underwriting spreadsheet like this, something more in depth. I've got this. I'm happy to share it with you. Mark was, you know, and he's shared it with the apartment focus group for years. I've made some changes, some updates to it. I'd be happy to share this with you. This is your practice tool. You have to get good at this. I already talked about education. Then I talked about underwriting. It's so key, and I think it's the one thing that really separates even smaller multifamily from bigger multifamily. You really have to get this stuff right. You're going to see here, I mean, just a lot goes into it, but this is, we actually bought a 45 unit and called it Dayton 45. I'm not very creative. And you can see here, you know, just as you're inputting numbers and what the spreadsheet will do for you, it's you have to input some of the numbers, but then it's going to spit out your annual debt payment for you. So, right? So you're going to put in the amount of debt you're going to get, what leverage you're going to get, and it's going to tell you what your debt payment is. And then it's going to subtract that debt payment from your net operating income. It's going to give you your net operating income. It's kind of buried by... this doesn't want to work. It's going to tell you, you can see here, it's figuring out your net operating income for you. So you've got there, real quick, so about the sixth line down, you've got your, that's gross potential rent income. That's per month, you know, per unit monthly. Look at that, like about six, seven lines down, that's 648. So I'm just asking you guys, does this meet the 1% rule? We bought, our purchase price was $2.5 million, and right under that, you can see we're buying for $55,000 per unit. So did we meet our 1% rule? Yes, we did. So just add zeros to that 648. I do this all the time, but you can buy at $64,800 per unit, and that's right at your 1% rule. So we're doing better than our 1% rule. We're buying for less than that. So that's just how you see that. But you go through, and what I like about this spreadsheet, the vacancy, I input that number, that 44,185. 10% vacancy, it'll tell you right there, it does that math for you. 10% vacancy is 35,000. So you can see I'm well above that. I'm at 12.6. You want to enter, and it tells you, enter the higher number. So you enter the higher number. You get down to the income, right? You've got the, and then your expenses. Again, that 200,000, I input that. That's what I got when I confirmed the expenses. When I didn't just take what the broker told me, but I went on the county auditor site, what are the taxes really? You know, I demanded that they send me some water bills, some of the electricity bills, the gas bills. I'm confirming this stuff. I'm talking to other investors. What are you paying? I'm talking to an insurance broker. What do you think you can get for me on insurance on this? Things like that, right? You really got to, and that's where I got the 200,000. And it tells you some of the averages, you know, 40 to 60% is what you're going to spend. If you've got a high-end property, you're going to spend less per unit because you're renting for a lot more per unit. So that the cost that you spend, if you can imagine, if I'm renting a unit for $2,000 versus one for $1,000, am I going to spend 50% on the $2,000? Am I going to spend $1,000 a month and only $500 on the cheaper one? No, it's probably going to be the opposite of that. So that's why there's a variance, but you've got to find that number. You got to put that in because 45% is only $171,000. Maybe I can get there. Again, that's pro forma. That's predicting the future. Maybe I think I can control expenses better than they have, and maybe you can. But for right now, it's $200,000. And so it tells you the expenses per unit. And then it's going to calculate for you that net operating income. It's going to do the math for you. And it tells you you're purchasing at a 7.2% cap rate. Okay, that's that purchase cap rate. Your desired purchase price, maybe you want to purchase at an 8% cap rate. So again, you can put that in. And this underwriting spreadsheet will tell you, well, if you want to purchase at an 8% cap rate because you're getting a 7% mortgage and you want that 1% of positive leverage, then you have to purchase this property for $2.26 million, not $2.5 million. Okay, so this is what underwriting does for you. Again, you have to do the work. You have to put in good data. You got to put in the right numbers. But when you do that, it's going to tell you what to pay for the property. If you want to buy it at an 8% cap rate, and you want to do that because you're getting a 7% mortgage and you want positive leverage.
So you're saying that 8% cap rate, if you have the 7% mortgage, you're going up a little bit from that in order to make sure you get the right.
Yep. Yes. Yep. Sure yes. Yes. Yep.
Okay.
Yes. Good point. She was asking, just confirming that the reason I wanted to get the 8% cap rate, the reason I went for that on my purchase price was because I'm assuming I'm getting a 7% mortgage and I want that positive leverage. She was just asking, is that right? Is that what I was talking about with the 8% cap rate? Did you ever, yeah, did somebody else? Okay, good. Yes, oh yeah. Yes, always. She asked, do you ask the seller for their T12, which means the trailing 12 months, so the most recent 12 months. Yeah, absolutely, and they'll give that to you. But, you know, we talked about capital expenditures. So if somebody needs new appliances and I replace those appliances, is that a capital expenditure or is that just a maintenance expense? Is that a normal turn expense? The reason I ask that is because if I consider that just a normal turn expense, that's going to end up in my expenses in this $200,000. If I call that a capital expenditure, that's out of this other bucket. I don't include that in the $200,000. So that's just one little example of where, like, you've got to confirm and, again, talk to other people. And when the seller tells you, I'm only spending, you know, this, you know, $100 a month per unit on maintenance. Talk to other investors. They're like, it's $700. It's $800 in this area, this, you know, C-class apartment building, $700, $800 per unit per year. That's the number you want to put in there. So yes, T12, but you gotta verify.
Sorry if I missed it, but did you mention what is the potential?
Okay, yeah. So at the top it starts off, 648, that's your potential rental income. That is what the leases say. So that's the way to confirm your income. That's what you should get each month, right? And then for the year, it's $350,000. But then you take out vacancy, bad debt. There's always, you guys own real estate, people don't always pay, right? Sometimes they don't pay. The more units they have, the more people that don't pay, the more people that you end up evicting and they didn't pay for 2 or 3 months. That's bad debt. Suddenly that's gone. So the 648, times 45 units, you know, over the year, that's 350,000. But you subtract 44,185 for that. But then I also got other income, so laundry income, all the other things that you can charge for, that gets you back up, so you're actually at 380, but you take that 44,000 away. So yes, that's what the gross, he was asking, if you guys didn't hear that, what do you mean by gross potential rental income and gross potential renter income per unit? That's what the leases say, it's what you should get, but you know you're not going to get all that. Yes? No, good question. Absolutely, yes. She asked, doesn't it mean if it's in a higher cap rate, it's in a rougher area, right? And that's 100% true. And that's how it should be. So your cap rate, again, think of that. That's kind of the return on your investment. If you bought it for all cash, that would be a return. Do you expect a higher return when you're investing in something more risky or a lower return? You expect a higher return. Just, it's the same thing if you're investing in a stock. If you invest in Amazon, we all know Amazon's doing great. They're going to be here for a while. You're not, you know, you don't, you, and they've done really well, the tech stocks have. But that story, people know about it. You're not going to get a great return because there's a lot of stability there. If you invest in a startup and they tell you, hey, we'll give you a 7% return, I'm not taking that. You might go bust. I want a big return in something that's risky. So if you're going to invest in a tougher area, you're going to expect a bigger return. Not as many people want to invest in that area. There's not as much demand. So you're going to expect a higher cap rate. Yes. Yeah, so be careful with that. Absolutely. I mean, and I fell into that. That's why I bought that house. It was so cheap. Well, it's because the basement was leaking and all these different things. You know, we've in our first apartment was in a rougher area, and we bought it an 8 cap. Actually, I think we were closer to a 9 cap and thought we won, and that's fine. But we sold at a 7 cap instead of a 5 cap where everybody else was selling. So, yes. Yeah, right. And that's what you want to go after. Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Yep, because they're really missing out. So, and sometimes with the poor management, sometimes you're buying at a lower cap rate, but again, you know, you're predicting the future. You know you can get it to a much higher cap rate because if you're increasing the NOI, your purchase price never changes once you buy it. If you increase your NOI, you just increased your cap rate. And if you know you can increase income, you know you can decrease expenses, your net operating income is going to go up. And then that purchase cap rate goes down even though you already purchased it. So you're building that positive leverage. So this is important. One of your action items. It's all about practice. Is to email me. If you guys all have my handout, you've got my email address. Email. Yes, you don't have it. It's on your handout, but it's info at threefoldreisinrealestateinvesting.com. Email me, I'll send you the spreadsheet. So you should do that today or tomorrow. And then you need to underwrite 10 deals. And then you need to have somebody check your work, make sure you're doing a good job underwriting. You don't want to keep underwriting incorrectly. Again, that's what is so powerful about apartment focus group. You know, Mark at the end would ask, does anybody have a deal? Let's underwrite this together. Let's do this together. Let's go through it. You need practice. You need to make sure you're doing it right. And then you can go do 100 of them. Yeah, info, at threefold. Yep, it's at the bottom here. T-H-R-E-E, so as in the number three, folding a piece of paper. REI, as in realestateinvesting.com. Hannah. Yep, yeah, it's on this sheet. To go. Yeah, that starts with the education. So yeah, you're going to have to get educated. Yes, right. Go to the apartment focus. So how do you underwrite? I mean, how do you know that? Yeah, and that's why it's step two and not step one. You've got to get educated. right? And the apartment focus group is such a big part of that. For me, there's other way. Again, you can pay for a coach. You can find somebody in here. But that's going on. You've got to have somebody help you. So I skipped deal three. I got to move a little bit faster. You guys have done such a good job. I really appreciate the questions. Keep them coming, and I'll be here afterward, of course. But finding deals then, okay? And this isn't like finding deals and then go purchase. This is finding deals to look at. This is finding deals to underwrite. This is finding deals to talk to the broker about. But you've got to be prepared first. So I like this quote that success is where preparation and opportunity meet, not just opportunity. You've got to be prepared. So you got to do that first. I really think in commercial, multifamily, and the bigger deals, you really have to be prepared to talk the talk. There is some different lingo, and you're going to let the broker know real fast that you don't know what you're talking about. If you and this is fine. Again, this is where I was. This is okay. This is why you get educated. This is why you got to, you know, get some coaching. But if you don't know what a cap rate is, if you don't know that IO means interest only, if you don't know what positive leverage means, you know, some of these things, they're just going to know you've never done a deal before, and you don't necessarily want them to know that. Because, you know, then why would they want to give that to you? So you really have to prepare. And you got to be prepared to explain your position. That's where the underwriting comes in. So when you underwrite well, you're going to be able to say, well, here's why I think it's worth this, because the net operating income's here. I'm looking for this. I want positive leverage. When you start saying things like that, they're going to take you seriously. And then, you know, that's when you know you're ready. The other big thing, this is a team sport. I'm going to talk about this a little more. I'm probably going to have to fly through it. But you have to have your team together. And this is the best way to convince a broker to take you seriously and to potentially award you the deal. When I was first talking to brokers and I owned a duplex, I kept telling him that my team owned 65 units because I considered Mark to be part of my team, whether he knew it or not. And he owned a 48 unit and a 25 unit. And Mark was kind enough. I actually did partner with Mark on my first deal. And so he was part of my team. But so my team owned 65 units. So when we were offering on a 16 unit, my team owned 65. Oh, okay, then your team can do 16, right? So having that team, but if I didn't know Mark, I wouldn't have said that. If I wasn't going to his apartment focus group and actually underwriting this 16 unit and showing it to Mark and him going, yeah, that looks good, then I can actually see that. That is my team. So you got to do that because brokers control the space. So it's about relationships with brokers. What brokers really care about, of course, they're going to get the highest price. They're not going to sell it to you, you know, at a huge discount. But what they really care about, realtors the same way, right? Like, and especially today, again, it's harder, much harder today to close deals because of where lending is, because of kind of some of the fear. Brokers want to know what's going to close. A typical closing is at least 60 days on a commercial property. Can you imagine thinking you're going to sell an apartment building for $5 million, you know, make a $100,000 commission, and you go 60 days and it doesn't close? That is catastrophic for them, right? That hurts. They don't want to do that. So if you're giving them an idea, if they feel like with you that you're not going to close, they're not going to award you a deal, even if you are the highest price. That's a little bit of a different thing here. They want surety of close and team and talk and talk. But that team, again, me telling him that we had 65 units, that made him much more sure than if I just said, well, I did a duplex, you know, so I'm pretty sure I can do a 16 unit, right? That's a big difference. So action items for finding deals, you can imagine. So get lunch and dinner with people. This is a great book. Joe Fairless is a local guy. He owns billions of dollars of apartments now, but he wrote a great book. It's like a textbook. I think it's a great book to go by. This is in your handout. All this stuff's in your handout. Right there. The Best Ever Real Estate Syndication Book. That's actually the name of the book. Yes. Yeah, real generic. So I think you got to set coffee dates with brokers, right? You got to meet with these people. Anybody have an idea of what the fourth, once you find the deal, what else do you need to be able to take down a deal? You got a deal, but what do you need to be able to take down a deal? Money. You need money. You got to find money. Yeah, and I think maybe somebody said a loan. Loan is the biggest part of that money. My wife, she got this from somebody else, but she would always say, trust equals time plus believable behavior. So she kept telling me that in the beginning, that it was going to take her time, and that really benefited us. I'd be remiss if I didn't say, I kind of playfully bashed on her a little bit, but that's actually a key to our success with my wife and I. you don't want to jump in, and I hope I've explained that you don't want to just jump into this. You really need to get educated. You really need to learn to underwrite. You really need to establish your team. There's a lot you need to do first. Sometimes in real estate, you do need to move slower, and sometimes moving slower ends up you move faster. That's what, because God put my wife and I together, and he made us so differently, because she's asking us to move slower, I'm constantly pushing forward. We did not, as you can tell with our story, we did not take very many steps. That's not because of me. That's because of Hannah. I would have flipped 10 houses. My wife's the one that said, that's nothing like what you explained to us. There's no cash flow there. Where's the cash flow? Right? That made me go to the duplex the next. And we did one flip. We did one duplex. That's because of Hannah. So if you have a spouse like that, be grateful. It's going to be very frustrating. But I think you're going to make less mistakes. I would have made a ton of mistakes. I would have done a ton of deals. And I don't think I'd be where I am today. I'm very confident I wouldn't. But we were very calculated because we move slower. So we actually move much faster because we move slower. So I just have to say that. So that's that. Time. A lot of this in multifamily, it definitely takes time. So believable behavior to me is just a track record. And so I'm sure you're asking, how do you have a track record when you don't have a track record? Right? So how do you go to somebody if you want to convince somebody, hey, I've got a great apartment deal. I know how to underwrite. You know, Mark taught me how to underwrite. I've underwritten this deal. I found a deal. You know, I want you to invest in with me. But I have no track record, right? With my 16 unit, I had no track record. Well, it doesn't have to be in real estate, right? With people you know, with your family, friends, people you go to church with, whatever, people you work with, you have a track record. It's just not in real estate. If you have a track record of integrity, your work ethic, and you've had some success at work, you know, people have seen you, the people that really know you, some of them are going to say, this person's going to have success in real estate. If you're talking to them about it and they can tell, they've been talking to me about real estate for a year, and I've seen their work ethic, I've seen their integrity, those are the people that are going to invest with you. Cool story real quick. My in-laws were our first investors, and that's kind of nerve-wracking, right? That's not great, but it was also a real confidence boost, especially to my wife, to say, okay, well, you know, Lee's crazy. He's, like, all in on real estate, but my dad is, like, very calculated, and he's deciding to get in on it with it, so big confidence boost. And one thing I just love about apartment buildings and what convinced me that I wanted to do bigger deals, because our first one was a 16-unit that they invested in with us, was that, you know, we ended up selling that. We did the small multis in 2019, sold them at the end of 2020, beginning of 2021. We rode the market. COVID took off. Fed printed $4 trillion. That helped, right? So we did really well. We worked really hard at it, but we did really well. But what was neat is, so Hannah and I made great money on that. We did really well. But so did my in-laws. And they didn't have to do the work. They just put in their hard-earned money that they spent years and years and years saving up. Years, right? Decades saving up that money that they put in. And what's really cool about multifamily, especially syndications, is you get more people get to experience the benefits of real estate. And so that's what I really enjoy about it. But those are your first investors. And it just takes time. I have a coach now, and I asked him, Andrew, how do you raise so much money? This guy raises millions of dollars in days. And he said, Lee, it took me 8 years of doing this, of doing apartments. I mean, and he was doing flips before that, but 8 years of being in multifamily. And he's like, then a switch flipped, and suddenly I can raise millions of dollars in days. He's like, but it took 8 years. So he's not my coach anymore. That's not the advice I wanted. I don't want to wait 8 years. I'm joking. That's the exact advice I needed. But that's true. Now, it does not take 8 years. It takes 8 years to raise millions of dollars in a day, maybe. You know, we have raised millions of dollars. It takes us weeks. It's difficult. But in this network and in your own network, you can. So we've done that. I'm just nowhere to his level. And we raise a couple million, and he raises, you know, 10 to 20 in 2 days. But no matter what, it takes time, because it's relationships. So I had developed relationships with my in-laws, and they saw my work ethic. They saw my integrity. They also didn't want to see their daughter end up on the street, so they wanted to help us out. But those are the people that are going to invest with you first. You got to develop relationships. So with people that you don't have that with, it's going to take, again, phone calls, lunches, you know, allowing those people to get to know you. And then one thing you really want to set up is that you want to educate these people, and you want to let them observe for a while. So one of the action items I have here, the way we do it, is you kind of have to put your track record. So that if people don't know you want to, like, I gave you guys this handout. Explains a little bit about me. You might want to put something like that together. And then you need to set up your email marketing campaign. So this is if you want to raise millions of dollars. If you don't and you just, you know, want to start small, that's fine. But if you want to raise millions, unless you know a lot of wealthy people in your family or at work or whatever, you're going to need to eventually capture people's email addresses. We use ActiveCampaign. And so we send out a monthly newsletter. And what that does for people, I always tell our investors, we're going to need to establish a relationship. You're not going to invest with me right away. That's actually, by law, we have to do that. But also, I would never expect somebody to invest with me right away. So I tell them, it's going to take time for me to, maybe, all of you might already be there, but I say, I need you to become comfortable and confident in investing in real estate. And so my newsletter and our education is getting them more comfortable and confident investing in real estate. And then I say, then you have to become comfortable and confident investing specifically with Threefold. Because just because you want to invest in apartment buildings doesn't mean you want to do it with me. Maybe you want to do it with somebody else. But my newsletter is going to, you know, and yours is going to convince them that they actually should do it with you, because you're the one that's establishing that you are the expert in the area and showing them what you're doing. So you might, in your newsletter, you can talk about, we just closed this deal, we just did this. They didn't get in on that one, but they see what you did, and then they see how you're doing with it because you're updating them on how you're doing. And some people are going to sit there for a year, sit there for 2 years. I've found some of the people that are really sophisticated investors and have hundreds of thousands invest with you, they might sit longer. You know, certainly longer than my in-laws. I called them. We gave them an award one time when we did like an investor dinner, and it was the blind investor because they jumped in before we had any track record. But you're going to have to get to know these people, right? It's a relationship thing. So the thing I'll hit on, and I hate that I'm going to take like a very little bit of time on this, because I wanted to make a point that this is where people don't spend enough time on, and here I have less than 5 minutes left, so I'm not going to spend much time on it. It doesn't matter if you buy, right? You guys know this. Most of you raise your hand that you've owned rental real estate. It doesn't matter how well you buy if you don't operate well. You can buy really well, operate terribly, you're going to make no money, you're going to lose money. You could actually buy pretty poorly and operate really well and still do really well. You spend a lot of time finding deals, you spend a lot of time underwriting, and you finally get the deal. But you might own this thing for 10 years. So to not spend time learning to operate would be a real big mistake when it took you 2 months to close on the deal and then you're going to own it for 10 years. You should know how to operate. In my opinion, experience is required. So I think you have two options. You can start small, because I don't think necessarily that much experience is required to own one single family. We bought one single family in our hometown. We were right there. It's one rental, you know, less downside. And then we did a duplex. I think you can kind of jump in and do that. So either do that or partner with experience. So when we were looking at a 16 unit, we were very overwhelmed. We had done a single family flip and a duplex, and then we jumped to a 16 unit. We were overwhelmed by the idea of managing 16 units. It felt like Mount Everest to us. And just imagining what, I mean, I know my wife was like, what does day one look like? How do we go out, introduce ourselves to 16 people, get 16 people to pay rent, take maintenance requests from 16 people? What if there's a fire? You know, all these things. Well, what we decided to do was to partner with a professional property management company who managed 1,000 units in that area. So for them, 16 units was nothing, right? Like for us, it was Mount Everest. For them, it's like, that's 1% of our portfolio, right? 1.6% of our portfolio. That's nothing, right? So to them, it was nothing. You partner with them, so you either gain the experience starting small, and I had gained a little bit, but not enough money, so you partner with them. For them, day one, I mean, when I ask them what day one looks like, they're like, we just go out there, we just, you know, it was nothing. So they're the ones that are going to do that. But you've got to get a good one. You've got to get a good one. The best way is referrals. That's why you're in this room. All those people that raised their hand, that's how I did it. You know, again, asking Mark, who should we have manage this? We start talking to people, start talking to other people. That's how you find it. And then you really have to manage them. So the buck still stops with you. It's still your property. If you have investors, they're your investors. You have the responsibility. So just because they're managing it doesn't mean you don't have to make sure they're doing it well. You know, in any business, you know, there's key performance indicators. You know, the underwriting will tell you what those are. You've got to follow, you know, what's our average rent? What's our vacancy? Occupancy is the number one reason you're not going to make money. If you cannot keep your occupancy up, that gets scary. As long as you stay occupied, if you're not going too crazy and you have good reserves, you're going to do well. right? Now, if you way overpaid, okay. But if you bought pretty well, if your property stays occupied, and if you've got a manager that's not paying attention to your property, I've been there, occupancy slips. And then suddenly it gets scary and cash flow goes down. So you have to manage them. So that's the action items. Figure out what that is for you. Again, through experience, you can figure that out. Talk to others. And you need a strategy for managing that. And then start talking to property managers if you're going to go that route. Key performance indicators is KPI. So this is a team sport. So I did, again, this is on your sheet. So start putting your team together. You need all these people on your team. If you guys email me, I'll send you this report because I don't have time to go through this. This is the first time I've given this specific presentation. So didn't get to go through it. I still think it's a good time to invest in real estate. I think you have to be very, Rocky and I were talking just last night. I think you have to be very patient right now because it is a very difficult time. We talked about that positive leverage. It's interest rates are really high right now. Cap rates are not really high in multifamily. So it's really hard to get that positive leverage. It's really hard to buy at the 1% rule. So it's really hard to follow. But I think all of you know and believe real estate is a great long-term investment. So if you're investing with a long-term view, if you get in well, if you've got good education, if you can operate well, it's still a good time. But I'm telling you, you've got to be really patient. Just real quick, the reason I think it's a good time is because I think we're on a one-track path. I do not think we're going to turn around the debt that our government is adding. We are a debt-driven society. That means a lot of things. It's recently meant inflation. It means the devaluation of our currency. You know, Robert Kiyosaki talks about this stuff all the time. You know, he's a little more, catastrophic than I am. But I think we're on a one-track path. And if we are, we're going to continue having inflation. And that means inflation of asset prices. So get on the good side of that. And then also when you have debt on a property, they inflate away your debt for you. I think we're going to have lower interest rates because I don't think our government can afford high interest rates for very long. So that's all good. So, and it goes back to your underwriting. So you got to go back to these rules. If you're buying with these rules, you're going to be able to do well. You guys know this. This is just a wrap up. But real estate is the best get rich slow scheme out there. It is, but you got to do it well, right? And so now that you know, it's time to go take these 5 steps. You guys have them all written down. My kids are very involved in our real estate business. If you didn't, we forced them into it. Now this doesn't want to work. And I'll put my information up here so you guys have that. Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.